All right. Let's get fired up here.
Maximum freedom. Read.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom. Read Rothbard.
Hello and welcome to the Actual Anarchy Podcast. Hello and welcome to the Actual Anarchy Podcast. This is the podcast where we talk about movies from a Rothbardian and anarcho-capitalist perspective. Tonight, it's a little bit of deja vu as we are continuing our series in The Matrix in the month of May, as we're going to be doing The Matrix Reloaded tonight. We did take a little side tour down to Mexico last night, in fact, for a Cinco de Mayo special on Desperado with our friend Johnny from Peddling Fiction. And that was quite an episode, and he has quite the podcast. So that was a lot of fun. I highly recommend that people check that out. You can find the show notes for this episode at actualanarchy.com/233. And the one on Desperado at actualanarchy.com/232. Now, before we introduce our guest, let's say hello to Robert, the co-host with the mo-host.
Vis-a-vis the mo-host of the co-hosts. Yes, thank you. Hello. It's good to be back. Always fun to talk about the mattress films, some of my favorites, the things to sleep on.
Yeah, it's going to be really good. And I want to hear a good womp. These are the sound effects for when I do the overlay of the movie title, which I always intend to do, but then I always fail to do other than tonight. So,
but now we got all the mad graphics. This is like super appropriate stuff. Except for me, I look a little out of sorts. I got the shades, but I don't got the fancy matrix behind me. Oh, well.
Oh, well, we're just going to have to make do, and that's quite all right. We'll just pretend like I'm Neo and I can see the code and shit.
And I'm in the real world.
You're fucking Cypher eating steaks, getting That's plugged right. back in. Because in the last episode, well, the last time we talked Matrix, you were like, man, you ruined my life with this shit. I want that blue pill sometimes. So
That's
anyway.
Right.
We should get into the Last Nighters portion and introduce our guest, because I want to get his take on the Matrix as well. And so vis-a-vis, ergo Proctor Hawk, let's get into the Last Nighters portion of the show. Hey everyone, it's Daniel Elwood, and my co-host is Robert Paul Johnson, and we are the Last Nighters. You can find us on lastnighters.com and also on the Liberty Movement's YouTube channel. We're going to be doing the month of May, all May long, The Matrix, and this is The Matrix Reloaded, and our guest is the great and wonderful and powerful Oz himself, Pat McFarlane of Liberty Weekly. He was reloading ammunition a few months ago, and so when we thought of doing Matrix movies, I was like, all right, we'll do Pat for Reloaded. Also, we've talked conspiracy in the past, and we have both seen a very long form presentation by a guy named Mark Passio, which talks about the Matrix series and how it relates to a religion of sorts. But Pat, welcome back to the show. And why don't you remind everyone, as if they don't know, where can they find what you do and what is it that you do?
Hey, brothers, how's it going? Really glad to see you again. It's been way too long. I'm Patrick McFarlane of the Liberty Weekly podcast. I'm an attorney. I'm licensed to practice in Wisconsin. I do libertarian legal theory on my website. Been doing it for a hot minute now. And yeah, glad to be joining you. You can find my content as well at thelibertarianinstitute.org alongside wonderful, wonderful contributors like Scott Horton, Pete Quinones, Kyle Anzalone, Keith Knight, and Tommy Salmons. So, good to see you guys. I'm excited to dive into this.
Right. I'm excited as well. I think that this will be a lot of fun. And I think you have brought visuals along for show and tell tonight.
Hell yeah.
I might have forgot to tell everyone, this is episode 176 of this year's show. Go to lastnarrative.com/176. Also, we had a little bit of pre-show bonus content, and we will do a little Kathleen Turner overdrive after this. You can find all that on our Patreon. Go to lastnarrative.com/Patreon. Throw about $5 our way, and we'll give you everything we've got, which, you know, ain't much. but you get what you pay for. So head on over to Patreon for that. Robert's adjusting his pod, it looks like, but I think he's all set. So how we normally start this off, and oh, you know what? I actually have to re-share this because you shared something and that screwed up what I was sharing, but now sharing is caring and it's going to be on screen in just a moment. Here we go. There it is. All right. So the Google information on the Matrix Reloaded. And I think I got to adjust the size a little bit. There we go. You can see it all now. I think so. Yeah.
Yep.
All right. The Matrix Reloaded 2003, 7.2 out of 10 on IMDb, 73% Rotten Tomatoes, 62% Metacritic, and 86% of Google users like it. Freedom Fighters Neo, played by Keanu Reeves, Trinity, Carrie-Anne Moss, and Morpheus Lawrence Fishburne continue to lead the revolt against the Machine Army, unleashing their arsenal of extraordinary skills and weaponry against the systematic forces of repression and exploitation.
The in their systemic quest, racism.
They almost got me there. They almost got me there. In their quest to save the human race from extinction, they gain greater insight into the construct of the Matrix and Neo's pivotal role in the fate of mankind. This came out May 16th, 2003 in Australia. The directors listed here, Lana and Lily Wachowski, had a box office of $741.8 million on a budget of $150 million. This is the follow-up to the original Matrix from 1999. And this was followed by Revolutions, which they shot back-to-back. So Revolutions came out, I think, 5 or 6 months later, I think in December of 2003. And this was the movie that was the last one that had the original Oracle in it. And then she died, I think, of diabetes or something. So that's why in the third Matrix, we have the different Oracle. But Robert, let's go to you for your opening salvo on the Matrix Reloaded.
Yeah, let's reload this, biatch. Yeah, so obviously the original Matrix, if you listen to the last episode, we talked about this, one of my favorites of all time. And the sequels were a bit of a letdown just because I was looking for more kind of philosophical, mind-blowing, cool shit. And instead, I got cool action scenes, some kind of confusing philosophy, and more questions than answers. Like, how exactly does it all work? They've destroyed Zion 6 times. What? Then they just build it, and there's no sign of these previous rebuildings. I like the idea of the one being like kind of the steam valve relief thing, and this cycle just perpetuates this eternal oppression, I guess you could call it. But you know, just from a popcorn steak and potatoes perspective, which is what I bring to this podcast, I bring the everyman. You know, I'm the everyman, you elitist assholes don't understand. But from the everyman's perspective, I wanted, you know, more cool, mind-blowing kind of stuff, and I didn't quite get that. What we did get was a Superman story where in order to actually have any kind of tension, we have to focus on side characters because Neo just comes in and fixes the problem whenever he shows up. And it's okay that we focus on side characters, but we definitely spend less time with him. I guess he's just more of a less of an interesting character at this point. Maybe we just understand he's the one, and what exactly does he have to do? Go to the source. What does that mean? We don't know what's going to happen. We don't know, but we're going to watch Morpheus and Trinity do some really cool shit on a highway they built, which is going to be sweet. It still holds up to this day. Had a lot of fun with the highway scene. Although I had an issue with the ghosts like pumping endlessly rounds into this car and never twins? Hitting anybody.
The White Boy Summer Twins?
They must have shot a couple hundred rounds into this car at, what, 20, 30 yards at the most, and you're not hitting anybody. Every time you fire another bullet, there's less and less tension because, well, apparently they're just not gonna hit anybody. This is just kind of boring, but they did a really good job with the speed. And when Trinity turns around and goes head on traffic, that's fantastic. I think though that they just ramped up Neo at the end of the Matrix too fast. He just becomes Superman too quickly. And he's just almost like a boring character that you have to throw 1,000 Smiths at him in order for him to have even kind of any fair fight, because otherwise he just solves the problem instantly. So I probably they maybe had a little bit of remorse when they had to come up with these sequels, because then they just got this Superman character and they're like, well, what do you do with the Superman character? He's just too strong.
Oh,
focus
yeah.
on the side characters.
I thought that maybe he wasn't powerful enough based on where they left him at the end of the original, where he's just like barely paying attention and fighting off all these agents and all that. In this one, it's still like he can handle them, but he's not doing it lackadaisically. It takes some effort. And so they sort of hand wave it away with him saying upgrades or whatever, but it didn't seem like he was as overpowered as I thought he should have been, how they ramped him up at the end. But it sounds like you thought he was still a little overpowered.
Well, he is in terms of fighting one agent, right? Like they have to throw a whole room of guys at him.
Yeah.
The Merovingian has a room
your typical
programs, like superhero characters. Exactly. They have to throw 1,000 Smiths at him, and then he can, it's an actual fair fight. If it's just one-on-one, yeah, he just blows up a Smith. I mean, who cares? They're nothing to him at this point. But yeah, you're right. There wasn't a scene where he's just like one-handing on people, because he's got to fight 20 of them. But,
right.
You know.
And there was a little bit of a gap that they sort of tried to fill in expositionally. Because apparently this one takes place about 6 months later after the events in the original one in Zion time. And so we get all this sort of backfill of this like mouse-like character kid who Neo saved him. And so this kid looks up to him so much, but it's all told as if we should already know about it, but it's the first time we're sort of hearing about it. And he's also so similar looking to the original mousy character in the first one that it's a little confusing, I think.
Yeah, and since it's a half of a movie, we get a set with the mouse character, but there's no real payoff. Like,
right.
What's his character supposed to even do? He carries some bags in this one. Okay, what happens? I mean, obviously we have to watch Revolutions, and then he does his thing. But if you're just watching this as a complete movie, it feels incomplete.
Right. Yeah, and I think that was a big controversy with the ending, that cliffhanger ending. Like, a lot of people were disappointed because I didn't pay to watch half a movie. I paid to watch a whole movie, even if it's going to be Snyder Cut length. You know, the first movie, it's a complete story. I mean, you could end it right there, and it sure leaves the door cracked for sequels. But you have the full story. And then this one, you're just kind of getting into it. And then, you got to wait 6 months. At least, back in the ancient days.
Right.
But anyway, should we bring Pat in for his take on your take and my take? What's your take, Pat?
Well, I think like one of the biggest reasons, at least according to Mark Passio, and I'll probably be relying on him a lot because this is one of my favorite presentations by him, but I love The Matrix. I just love it. But he says people didn't like the second movie because the first movie addresses what is the Matrix. The second movie addresses why are we in the Matrix. And the third movie addresses how to get out of the Matrix. And people are interested in the first question, but they're not interested in the second and third questions because there's some like inconvenient truths there.
I can relate.
Yeah. So, yeah, I don't know. They were largely forgettable for me, I was 6 years old in 1999 when The Matrix came out. And I remember that the first DVD that we ever bought with our new DVD player was The Matrix. And I watched the shit out of that. But I didn't watch the second or third ones much at all. Maybe one or two times.
Yep, that's about my experience too. Yeah. The first movie is so good. It's such a complete story. And then the second one and the third one they're more of the story and they kind of finish it off. But
where do you go from the first movie? It's like,
I don't think they set it up to be, they leave it open-ended.
Yeah.
But you almost don't need sequels. It almost felt like Joel Silver was like, we need to make more money. Yeah. Okay. Come up with something.
Well, it's like a good horror film, a really good horror film doesn't show the monster very much except once. And in The Matrix, it's almost like, the whole Zion and everything about the One and Neo is almost better if you have to imagine it yourself. Because whatever they're going to portray is going to be lackluster because it's not as good as what you imagine it to be.
100%. Absolutely.
Yeah. Now to take off on your passio where he's saying the second movie is the why we're in the Matrix, right?
Mm-hmm.
It seems as if now I haven't seen this in a long time, but they do make a big point about choice versus control. And they bring it up in a couple of different ways in this movie. Not only like Neo's making choices, or is he being controlled? Is Neo a control himself? Is Zion a control? Is the world, the real world that we're seeing in this, actually also in the Matrix? Is all of this a steam right. release valve? Because, you know, when the Sentinels are about to attack them and Neo can stop them in the real world, that's a sign that perhaps we're still in the Matrix.
Right. Yeah. Right. I didn't even,
Either we're still in the Matrix or Neo is getting even more powerful and hence even more boring.
Yeah, right.
Whoa.
Well, it's like it's very reminiscent of 1984. I mean, it really kind of feels like it harkens back to that, where that's the ultimate like deflationary thing that just deflates you, because it's like, you know, you get interested in the resistance, but then you realize the resistance is just controlled opposition. And that's what it is with what Goldstein. I can think of so many other things. I mean, So many, I mean, help me out here if you remember any dystopian films where it turns out the resistance is actually just an arm of the state.
Yeah, I'm no help. Sorry.
I can't. My brain doesn't work, but I believe you.
Yes.
Right. Well, in this one, we're introduced to the idea of the Oracle being a control mechanism. And then we're introduced to the Architect being the father of the Matrix, if she's the mother of the Matrix, and they're both coming up with ways of control. And in fact, I think the Architect, in his convoluted ergo Proctor poop speech, sort of says that Neo himself is a form of control. And this is the sixth time that he's come through. And while he does do things a little bit differently each time, because there is sort of an element of free will or an element of choice that is possible, that perhaps Neo is not human after all. He is perhaps a sentient AI like program, similar to a Smith is in this character, in this movie.
Right. Which leads credence to the idea that the real world is actually still the Matrix.
I never considered that possibility.
Right. Well, you remember in the first one, we talked about how entire crops were lost because there was this utopian society and people were rejecting it with their minds. And so they had to have this struggling planet, you know, this difficult life that people would accept, because if it was too good, they wouldn't believe it. So maybe that's what the Zion being destroyed five or six times is, a Zion within the Matrix. So it's everyone's still plugged in, but they think they're getting unplugged and they think they're fighting the Sentinels and defeating the machines. And really, we're just all plugged in the entire time.
We're just all in the pods. This makes me think about that South Park episode where they're all just drinking Jameson. I don't know if you've seen that one. It's like Stan discovers this whole group of like Matrix type people, but when they plug you into the Matrix, they really just bring down a huge bottle of Jameson and it gets plugged into your mouth and you just chug it.
Oh, nice. Nice. Yeah, I have not seen that one.
It's about the illusion of control is what it is. And like, I think that's like, why we're in the Matrix is because we need that illusion of control in order for us to accept the, you know, the bars of the prison cell we're in.
Okay. So not just the illusion of choice, but also the illusion of control.
Sorry, the illusion of choice. You're right. Sorry.
I mean, I could see the illusion of control being a thing too. Like, cause then those who think that they can see, those who think they've taken the red pill.
Yeah.
Think that there is a control that they are overcoming and defeating.
Yeah. And you need that kind of resistance. Why would you need that kind of resistance though? If I'm like, if you're in the mind of the Merovingian and the ones who benefit from the control system, why would you need to constantly be, what is the purpose of the release valve?
Well, if we believe the story from the original Matrix, where they say that the minds rejected it, and in crops were lost, that meant that the humans in the pods died.
Mm-hmm.
And so perhaps the control, it's necessary to keep the humans alive because they think that there's this struggle that they're involved in. And there's
and they
a gotta purpose give, in that.
And they have to have, yeah, they have purpose. They have the ability to win, or at least the perceived chance to win. You feel more important that way. You have some successes, you have some losses, but you have the chance of success, and your choices seem to matter. It's a huge, huge psychological boon for sure. I don't know if you didn't necessarily die otherwise, because we don't have that ability to change the real world like that, but maybe communism does. I don't know.
It's like Corbett had that documentary about the rat experiment, the human rat experiment, where they put the rat utopia, where if everything, what was it? That if everything was limitless, are you familiar
with this experiment? Yeah. He made a giant rat mansion, and they grew, they reproduced, but they stopped at some point. Like they wouldn't fill up all the space and eat all the food. They just kind of stopped, and they got lazy, and they stopped having sex, and they didn't even fight with each other. Really. They didn't compete for anything. They just kind of quit being rats.
Yeah. In Corbett's documentary or his piece on it, he talked about how the guy who designed the experiment, it was always about more than just rats. And he has this really like weird thing in his paper that he eventually wrote about it, about how it's really about controlling the human race. It's pretty deep. Maybe I'll send a link so we can talk, put it in the show notes.
Yeah, maybe we're seeing the fruits of that research being deployed now.
Right now, yeah.
Yeah, so some of the notes that I have, if we're ready to move on to a couple of different things here, are just quotes that Morpheus said that I thought were really interesting. And I identified with him in a lot of ways. So he has so much faith in that he has the one true kind of concept or philosophy or the prophecy. And I liken this to how we all adopt a common, you know, anarchist, capitalist, libertarian non-aggression principle philosophy, and that is the retort to not everyone believes as you do. Well, my beliefs do not require that they do. Unlike the statist mind, which does require that you also go along with their edicts.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a good quote. I wrote that one down myself. It's very much when you have certainty and understanding, you're not necessarily going to take some dumbass criticism from some rando and have it shock your and break your worldview. It's a complete worldview that, and to your point, their belief systems, yeah, you have to go along with all this crap, and it's constantly changing.
Yeah, and if you don't like it,
leave. That hive mind.
If you don't like it, leave. Well, so just by being in a geographic area, you're basically submitting to anything and everything that they can conceive of, even going forward. And what if it's worldwide like it is now?
Yeah, where do you go? You can like it, leave.
Yeah. Pat, you got any comments on this before I move on to my next present day relevant quote?
I kind of likened it to the struggle between Morpheus and this other commander guy from Zion really reminded me of kind of what's going on with the Mises Caucus and Dave Smith. Is that, you know, we're both kind of members of Zion, for lack of a better term, but Morpheus, if I can compare Dave Smith to Morpheus, has this idea that, you know, we have to have faith in the message and faith in you know, not going about the pragmatic kind of thing, which is what this commander guy is talking about. He's like, there's machines headed to the city right now, and we need to do things to stop them. And Morpheus is like, well, it's about more than that. It's about Neo. It's about the message. It's about, you know, waking people up. And I think that's directly relevant, you know, to what's going on, what has gone on with the struggle in the libertarian movement between the blue-pilled libertarians and people who are, you know, super principled.
Yeah, I agree with that. That's a really good point. I think that the reason that Ron Paul was so popular and a movement sparked behind him was because he was so on message. You know, for the most part, there's a couple of things I'd nitpick with, but he had to sort of appease to the constitutionalist crowd and Republicans, the more hardcore kindred spirits, I would say, to some of our at least free market leanings. But there is a case for some pragmatism, I think. you know, on a local level or in a defensive capacity, making change where you can. I think Hans Hermann Hoppe had a paper and a speech about what must be done, and it's all about getting active locally to make your the things that affect you more directly lean towards more freedom. But I think Dave's point is even probably more powerful, and that is if you have the platform, and they're basically giving you a platform when you're looking at a national race, that's where you can get the message out, and that's what needs to be pure enough to where people can hear it and be drawn to it. And if you're going to just kowtow and acquiesce every step along the way and just kind of try to meet in the middle or be, you know, like the Gary Johnson style, like, oh, well, we're fiscally conservative, but socially liberal, or even the Rand Paul thing where, you know, he just tried to be like sort of maverick, sort of radical, but not quite. You know, he tried to meet in the middle a little bit too much. And I think that those just become milquetoast, watered down messages that don't inspire people. I mean, who's going to go to the Ramparts for 3% lower taxes? You know, I think that was a Murray Rothbard quote. You know, he's like, we need to, you know, actually inspire people with like a real goal and a real vision that people are going to be willing to work for and take pride in that. Sort of like, you know, we were talking about how it can be a control, but you know, having a goal and having a drive to work towards something, I think is a very powerful thing. And when you don't have a philosophically grounded message, you lose that.
Yeah. You end up trying to please everybody and end up appealing to nobody.
Right. Which is pretty useless. All right. Well, I have my next quote that I want to bring up, and this one, man, I thought this applied perfectly to today. They're having that same kind of discussion. It's Morpheus and the council and that, what's the guy's name? Maddox, maybe the commander guy who wants the extra two ships to defend against the alien or the Sentinel invasion. Their argument is we don't want a panic. So we're not going to tell people the truth or the whole truth. You know, we're going to tell them a little bit. We're going to be like, oh yeah, there's some stuff that might be happening, but you know, don't tell them too much. And Morpheus is like, no, give them the truth. Let them decide for themselves and they won't panic. This is almost like, they could have played this a year ago, you know, where I think Fauci even admitted, well, the reason we originally didn't advocate for masks was because we wanted to save them for the healthcare workers. So we lied about not needing them so that they wouldn't be all bought up and so they'd still be available for people. And while that may have been noble at the time, at least in intention, in practice, they're lying through their teeth. And I think that If they should have any role at all, it should be to impartially and objectively give you the information so you can make your own risk assessment and make your own decisions on what you are going to do for yourself and for your loved ones. And I think that that would have gone a very much longer way in making this situation have been handled so much better. When we were on with Bob Murphy talking about They Live last fall, he made the point that if you let people make their choices, then you're not going to be corralling everybody into this one size fits all thing. So like all the mom and pop shops got shut down and everyone's now funneled into the big box store. So now you have concentrations of people trying to buy things and it gives you the exact opposite situation of what you would want if you're trying to maintain distancing. Whereas if you let the businesses remain open and advertise what level of regulations or requirements are necessary, then consumers could choose, hey, I'm comfortable with this level of risk, so I'll go here. And you, Robert, you might have been comfortable with even more risk, so you go over here where they're just raw dogging life with their faces, you know. And then some of the oldsters would be like wearing the, you know, 17 masks and the glasses, you know, because it can get in your eyes, apparently. At least that's what he was saying last July. But then there would be a place for them that would cater to that, you know. And so by eliminating those choices, we not only got the opposite effect of what they were trying to get, but we also lost valuable information. Because then we would have been able to see, okay, what's it like when you do this? What's it like when you do that? What kinds of solutions are going to come up and spring forth spontaneously as people are trying to deal with this to satisfy consumers who now have an awareness of some greater risk. You know, and initially nobody knew what the scale of that risk was. And my point back then was, well, even if it's the most deadly thing in the world, you want freedom to be able to deal with it.
Yeah, and it's about respect and treating people like adults or like children. You give the people the most complete information you have, and they will probably act better than if you give them some small hint of information, and then their minds are left to run wild, seeking out all sorts of different kinds of information, and who knows what they're thinking.
Yeah, buddy. Sorry, I pulled you up, Pat, while Robert was talking. I was trying to grab your links so I could put them on our show notes page. But
I thought I'd make it a little easy for you.
Yeah, thank you. So anyway, I thought that was a really good quote from Morpheus. And I think that, you know, he was vindicated in this. He told them the truth, and he got them inspired against a common enemy. And he got them fired up to defend Zion. And I think that's what you want. You know, you want people to be able to make the decision for themselves. I mean, can you imagine if they had gone that other dude's route? You know, the people would have just been like, oh, nothing's wrong. Okay. Life is, yeah, you know, going on.
Until it's too late, probably.
Yeah, until the Sentinels are beating on the door, you know, and nobody's prepared for shit. And nobody's like, I don't know, like made peace with it or been like, okay, you know, they've come to terms with it. Like, okay, we've got 72 hours before this thing happens. And you go through all those, you know, mental processes, the stages of grief or whatever. And then you have resolve to deal with it. But, you know, if they just lie to you to appease you and just keep you docile and then you're surprised with it, then what's your reaction going to be then? You know, you haven't processed any of this information. You haven't made any plans whatsoever. You don't know if you're, you know, in a position to do the thing that you think had you been given the time to actually prepare that you would have done differently, you know?
Yeah. And it's centralized, you know, thinking. Like, he knows better than all these other people. He's not soliciting ideas from this vast number of people that might have a really good idea about how to help, but he wants to control information. He wants to not let them know. So he doesn't get that help. They're operating under a very short time frame anyway, but you know, when it's all hands on deck time, you treat people like adults and you get help from wherever you can. You know, you give everybody the information and you never know where some genius idea is going to come from.
Right. And while I will lend some plausibility to his argument, we hear it all the time. And they even make mention of it is, you know, hey, we're not as well versed in defending the city as you are. So we will, you know, listen to your arguments and adhere to your advice. But he wanted it to be only his decision. You know, he wanted that autocratic authority of, hey, I'm the expert here. And so I should be the one calling the shots. And of course, we see what that's been doing in present day as well.
Do we think that given the opportunity Morpheus would have had it his way, would he have decided to defend the city at all? Or would he have put 100% of all the efforts into Neo's mission?
I think that Morpheus was probably okay with just having some resources devoted to his mission.
Two or three ships. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And really that's almost a marginal utility argument, because to him, those two or three ships are vitally important to his belief in the prophecy. Whereas for Maddox or whatever the guy's name is, it's two or three more ships out of, I don't know, dozens. I don't even know how many they have, but each additional ship to him, while he is claiming it has a lot of value to him, it's really, you know, just a couple more than a bunch that he already has.
Indeed. You got any more quotes from Morpheus, Daniel?
There's another quote when he's making his speech to all the people. He says, "We must shed our fear of it because we are still here." And I think we could use some of that for the population these days as well. We need to shed our fear of the propaganda porn that is being spilled out upon the airwaves and the websites. There are so many holes in their arguments these days and in their data. Tom Woods had an email today where he has the chart compared for hospitalization rates between the 25 most restrictive states and the 25 least restrictive states. And the two lines are virtually mirror images of each other. Like they're like the same, you know, like they're hardly different at all.
That's like day 390 something to slow the spread, and only 99.998 of us remain.
Right, right.
Like writing my apocalypse journal.
Yeah, if someone were to write an apocalyptic novel based on today, I don't know if anybody would read it.
I wouldn't.
Yeah, it's so bizarre. But anyway, we had an example here where the guy who delivers our monthly meat box, we have the butcher box thing.
Nice.
And I've been marking time with his arrivals because I've lost all concept of time since the 15 days or whatever to flatten the curve. So anyway, it seems like he was just here and then he's back again. And that's been going on for months. Well, anyway, he's always been wearing a mask. And sometimes I see him driving through the neighborhood, making deliveries, wearing a mask.
By himself?
By himself. Not today. No mask today. And so when he approached, I was like, oh man, it's so good to see your face. And we started talking and he's like, man, yeah, I'm just so over it. And he said that he had gotten the vaccine. I'm like, okay, you know, that's cool. If that's what you really wanted for me, not for me. I don't like the lack of liability for them. I don't like that they're saying it's totally safe and 95% effective. And I've seen some of the numbers behind that and they're fucking lying. So, but we started talking about these curves I was just mentioning and how, you know, if you're going to argue for this massive imposition on people's lives, locking them down, forcing masks, mandates, shutting down businesses, destroying lives, we're seeing all of these collateral damage coming from this with depression, suicides, drug overdoses, missed cancer screenings, heart disease, people dying of heart attacks because they're afraid to go to the hospital, and all of those things, all of those are the damage caused that would not have occurred had they not forced these lockdowns. You better damn well see a big, significant difference between those areas that had these restrictions and those that did not. And the fact that there is hardly any difference at all shows you that it was all for nothing. All it is causing harm. So it's not like how they played in their heads that, oh, well, if we didn't do this, then there would have been even more deaths than the 600,000 or whatever number they're throwing out these days. You know what the average age is of people who died with coronavirus?
It's the average age of death at all.
80.
Higher.
Yeah, 80. So, you know, people die. That happens. Car accidents, cancer, heart disease, accidents. You know, you name it. People die all the time. Old age. You're not going to eliminate death. I remember when Cuomo was doing his Emmy-winning daily speeches. He's like, the virus is death. We're fighting death. Well, I mean, yep. he had some inside info on that because he was putting the virus right into the most vulnerable population. But anyway,
but yeah, he's obviously a fearmonger. He's essentially equating the risk of dying from corona to be death for anybody.
Right. If you get it, you're dead. When it's you get it, and 99.98% of you are not going to die.
Yep. And, you know, and it's been a real trick to go from 15 days to flatten the curve because we're all going to get it eventually, right? I mean, we're just trying to not overwhelm the healthcare system to, well, we got to go until there's new cases.
Right. Yeah. That was the original argument is that
nobody ever gets sick.
Yeah. We just need to not overwhelm the hospitals and the resources. So let's flatten it. So we have the same amount of cases or whatever, but we have the resources over the time horizon to be able to manage it without overextending those available resources. That was the original argument. Now, have they changed their minds and flip-flopped like 100 times since then? Yes, they have. So I don't know if they would still make that argument or not, but it's been over a year now. Anyway, we should probably talk about this movie.
Well, no, let's not talk about the movie because you got me fired up now, Daniel.
All right.
So not only that, but they've also done a little sleight of hand with the idea that we're not going to get through this to the other side without a vaccine.
Oh, yeah.
As if human beings for our entire history haven't been dealing with diseases and getting through them without vaccines. Now this whole new COVID-19 is so scary and whatever. We have to have a vaccine or else we just can't go back to normal life. Because fear, and it's a real mindfuck. It's just absolutely just piling on the fear.
We must shed our fear of it. We are still here.
We're still here, and human beings are still here. We've been here. We've dealt with these things in the past, and we haven't freaked out like a bunch of little nanny bitches.
All right, so here's a related
mind killer.
That's right. That's
here is the mind
right.
killer. All right, here's a related quote that maybe explains where some of this comes from. What do all men with power want?
More power.
More power.
That's right.
Okay, someone said, okay, Cuomo said that we're fighting against death. But you know who is death? Agent Smith. So that's the perfect segue. Come on. So there's
Agent
a lot
Smith
of symbolism.
Is that what you're saying?
Agent Smith is the Reaper?
Represents death. Yeah. This is, he represents the death of compassion, the cremation of care. So I'm going to take this down the conspiracy rabbit hole. Are you ready for this?
Nice. Let's do it.
There's,
come on.
There's so much symbology behind this fucking movie. So let's. I'll
pull up the main screen.
What's that?
You want me to pull up your screen here?
Yeah, I got you. I got you, fam.
All right. Adding to the stream now.
So this is the symbology behind the movie, basically, that the Neo and Morpheus and Trinity represent the three parts of the human consciousness, basically, that Trinity is the most important actually character in the whole trilogy, I think, is that she represents, you know, our compassion and love and heart and care and spirit. And, you know, that's basically Passio talks about how in the second movie is about how we are always saving Trinity, because at the beginning of every Matrix movie, Trinity is in grave peril. And, you know, Morpheus is asleep and Neo is asleep in the beginning of every movie. And he represents the common man, our will, our courage, our conscience, and our freedom in our action. And so basically the whole series is about Neo saving Trinity, which is Trinity is what's needed to overcome the control system. And Morpheus is the one who wakes Neo up. So they connect through Trinity, who's the heart, and you know, Morpheus wakes up Neo, and that's where we get all this stuff. So pretty interesting stuff. Like, I didn't think about it until it's true, right? That Trinity is in grave mortal danger at the beginning of every film. I can't think of the third movie. What peril is she in?
Well, Neo's in a coma, and the dude who's been taken over by Agent Smith threatens him early on in the third film, if I recall. I haven't seen it yet, but we will see it because we're talking about it next week with Mike C. of Mechanical Dream Revolution.
Who's been adding awesome comments, by the way.
Well, he's an awesome guy. Makes awesome music, too.
So, you know, here's some more slides from Mark Passio's thing about Neo being our neocortex and our being the new man, which I thought was a communist concept, wasn't it? But it's all kind of about ascending to a new reality, or to a new like plane of being, because, you know, that's how we're going to ascend, to get beyond the matrix, kind of like becoming anarchistic beings is ascending beyond this slave planet system that we live in right now. So
prison planet.
I'll just go through these quick. So the most powerful world is no, and that's what Neo says at the end of the first movie. So learning to say no to this. We already talked about a lot of this, but yeah, so basically this is what Agent Smith does. Is I wrote an article on Substack called Defiling the Sacred Feminine. And can you see that on the screen right now? Substack.
Yeah, the words are small, but I'm sure they're really good.
They are very good. But basically, I tied it into Bohemian Grove, man. We're going to go deep back to the OG Alex Jones shit. Bohemian Grove, they perform that ritual called the cremation of care. And I think it's all about killing Trinity, basically, because if Trinity represents, you know, our compassion, our care, that ritual, the cremation of care, is all about killing that part of us which allows us to escape the matrix. And that's what the elites allegedly do at Bohemian Grove. And I just thought that was really interesting. But that's what Agent Smith does throughout the second movie, is that he goes to the heart. It's very symbolic that he stabs people in the heart with his hand and he turns their hearts black. Basically, he's taking the life out of them, killing care.
Doesn't he turn them into another clone of him?
Into killers, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Interesting. Now, this Mark Passio presentation, it's something like 4 hours long, right?
It's two.
Oh, just two? Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I will put that on our show notes page as well. I remember watching it probably like 10 years ago and it being rather interesting.
What do you guys think about the Merovingian? Because that's another part of this whole conspiracy kind of dark thing, because the Merovingian bloodline is what lots of like Christians and fundamentalists, they think that the Merovingian bloodline will birth the Antichrist. And it's interesting that on something like The Matrix Reloaded, some huge blockbuster major film directly names a character the Merovingian, when the Merovingian bloodline is supposed to be one of the bloodlines that produces like the ruling class in society, kind of like the New World Order stuff.
Is that what it is? I always thought the Merovingian was the bloodline of Christ.
See, that's the dark occult bloodline is. I was reading an article earlier, but right like before we went on, about how, you know, like Christian-y kind of doomsday conspiracy theorists think that the Da Vinci Code was part of this huge PR campaign to make people think the Merovingians are descended of Christ, but really they're the dark occultists who are behind like the large, like the most evil bloodlines, like the Rothschilds are part of the Merovingian bloodline. So I don't know. How deep do you want to go on this shit?
I mean, I have no idea about any of this crap, but I'm loving it. So keep going.
Well, essentially the Merovingian, he represents those in the power structure who benefit the most from the Matrix system is what he does. Now, I don't know exactly the point that Mark Passio was getting at in this slide, but it looks really fancy.
Well, that's basically the point that the Merovingian is making in this, because Neo and Morpheus and Trinity come and they're trying to get the Keymaker from him, and he sort of stonewalls them and sort of toys with them, I think, but then is betrayed by his wife, Persephone, because he was unfaithful to her.
And Passio has a whole thing about Persephone and something about like Greek mythology and stuff, and it makes total awesome sense, but I just can't remember what it is. But she's important for sure.
I did think that was a little bit weird that she wanted a kiss from Neo, as if he was kissing Trinity.
There was some high artistic symbology behind that.
Okay.
Yeah, Persephone is the wife of Hades, the god of the underworld. So I don't know how that plays in.
So, but is that to tell us that perhaps the Merovingian in this story is a Hades character?
Yeah.
It seems like it.
Yeah. And he's speaking French, which is very telling. Because the Merovingian bloodline descends from the Franks, from the Frankish kings.
Yeah,
I just made that connection.
Interesting.
Yeah. Let's see. I don't have any other slides for us. That's it. It's done.
Okay, I'm gonna pull that down then. Pull it. All right. So
that's such a loss of life.
So this has been interesting. Now, how does this tie back to the movie? Because you know, most of us are here because of our disobedience, our affinity for disobedience. What do you take away from this movie? Like, does this help with the entire story, or do you, Robert, still feel like the first movie is the only real movie worth watching and that's the complete story?
Well, for me, I love the original Matrix. You can be taken apart on so many levels. And it has a real rebellious, even if it's just a dumb teenager rebellion, right? Like, I mean, I'm sure like every Antifa member loves the Matrix just as much as I do. This movie, if they were exploring some more ideas, but yeah, it's definitely unnecessary. It's not like it completes anything that, you know, that the first movie was lacking anything. So yeah, I don't even really know what to say here. It's more fun, deeper rabbit hole talk, but it's like, for those that want to go deeper, you can do that. But for the vast majority of us, the Matrix is enough. I guess
right.
That's
Now, before we go to Pat, I wanted to also ask you, Robert, you said that you liked the action sequences in this one, but I found them to look pretty dated CGI style in a lot of ways. And I think because they found that they couldn't do the same kind of manual wire work and rigging that they were doing with the cameras to get the Matrix, you know, like 3D motion kind of thing that they were doing in the original. So they did a computer program that is sort of developed to be able to do this. And I think it looks almost video game-ish, especially the Smith fight. And whenever Neo is like flying around, it just looks a little plasticky. It looks a little like he's a toy or something like that.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. But they were, I mean, these movies cost like a bajillion dollars at the time, and they were developing all kinds of fantastic technology. And that's the nature of the game when you rely too much on CGI. It's eventually going to look dated. Like the, you know, the practical stuff on the freeway looks fantastic, but then they go to the two semis smashing into each other, and then the buckling and the warping and the whatever, and then that looks like more like a PS2 graphic. It's really, it's unfortunate. It really is unfortunate. The bullet effects, all the CGI, they made it look as good as they possibly could at the time, and it just looks poor because of all the amazing advancements we've done. All the amazing advancements in technology that have created look poor. So,
right, and what they were doing at the time was probably advancing things beyond what they were before that.
Yeah, it's it cuts like a knife. It looks so good at the time, and then it ages poorly. But you know, they got their money, and I still had a great time with it. The bad graphics don't really, you know, it doesn't take away too much of my enjoyment. But you're right, you're right. It does look bad. Objectively, especially for somebody that is watching this movie for the first time. If you're watching it for the first time in 2021 and you're like, what's the big deal about this movie? I've heard so much people talk about it all the time. Let me look at it. And you're like, really? This looks like that's shit. What's the shit on the screen? I don't know. What's the deal?
Yeah. I mean, the first one's still bad,
but the ghost effects, the twins, when they transform into their hollow selves, that, you know, it's not that great.
You mean the Ghostbusters effect?
Yeah, it's just not, it's not up to today's standards, and why would it be? But I mean, we'll see what we get with the remake here or whatever it is they're doing. I'm sure it'll look amazing. It'll look photorealistic for our today's eyeballs, but in 20, 30 years, will it look as bad again? Yeah, probably.
Yeah, fortunately my eyes are deteriorating already. So by then, I mean, it'll just be a smudgy blur and I won't be able to tell the difference anyway.
That's right. Your cataracts will be covering everything and everything will be dark.
All right. So, Pat, do you have any final points? We're going to need to start winding this one down already.
Yeah, I kind of think, you know, from the perspective of completing the philosophy, movies 2 and 3 are necessary. But from a storytelling standpoint, I think you could have better ended it with just the one. But knowing how much secret symbology is behind this, and you'd really have to watch that Passio presentation to really start to appreciate it, because there's so much more hidden gem stuff in there. All the actors had to read Simulacra and Simulation and a whole bunch of philosophy before they even read the script. So I think I'll cite Wikipedia on that, but I still really like the movie. I think that Reloaded aged better. Like when I was a kid and watching Reloaded, it just wasn't nearly as good. And I think there's several reasons behind that, but I would say it's a little better upon rewatching, but it's not great. So if I was to give the original Matrix like a 9.7, I would give this one maybe like a 7.5 out of 10.
Oh, okay. Interesting. All right. So we're already in final summary review. That's great. And I was curious what your score was for the original. So thank you for that. And I think that Robert, you were having a similar thought where rewatching this, the movie is actually better than you remember, despite the graphics not being as good as they once were. So right, I'm sure like flip flopped.
Yeah. 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 I mean, the original Matrix, you were still high on the original Matrix. You still had massive anticipation. Half of it's, you know, half of how much you're going to enjoy a film is how much do you anticipate it being good, or how good do you anticipate it being? So after The Matrix, you're like, well, the next movie is going to be even better. And of course, they created a masterpiece, so the only way direction they could go was down. But I didn't know that at the time. At the time, I'm like, these guys are geniuses. They've got this plan. They're going to make this whole big story that's going to be incredible. And then instead, we got what we got. Now, like Pat said, you come back to it, at least I did, and I'm like, you know, it really wasn't that bad. There's still a lot to enjoy. There's still some good philosophy. There's a whole lot of great action. They did ramp up the action. You can't argue with that. They ramped it up. And even though the tension is down, I think any time where you remove death as a possibility for one of the main characters, you deflate that tension balloon. And, you know, Neo gets resurrected at the end of the first Matrix. Trinity gets resurrected at the end of this movie. You know, it just, Neo's too powerful for me. Neo's just too powerful. But the movie itself is still a lot of fun. I'm actually looking forward to watch Revolutions, although I remember Revolutions being my least favorite. And we'll see. Isn't it a bit long? And there's a whole lot going on in like the real world that just isn't super great. I don't know. We'll see. I don't remember a lot of it. And what I do remember wasn't good. So I remember Neo being carried off dead by machines into a white light. And anyway, there's flashes of stuff, but it's not as memorable as that first Matrix, of course. So right. Yeah, for Pat's score, I gave the original Matrix 9.9 out of 10. And I am going to give this like a 7.2. It's good. It's still recommended. But it's not a masterpiece that the original was, for sure. Not for me.
All right, very good. Well, I agree with both of you guys in that when I rewatched this most recent time, I actually enjoyed it more than I thought I would, just from my old recollection of it not being that great. But you're right. When you revisit it, it is actually pretty good. Granted, it does look a little bit dated. And in some ways, I sort of wish that I had watched Revolutions again before we had our discussion tonight, but then I probably would have had an even more confused mind on what was going on and what thing happened in what movie. So I think we probably did the best we could as far as watching the one movie, talking about it, and then next week when Mike C comes, we'll do Revolutions and just focus on that movie and a little bit of the original, I think, because Mike's been telling us a lot of interesting stuff in some of the pre-show content. He hopped on with us before we did the original Matrix episode 2 weeks ago and was telling us some interesting things. So that will be a fun conversation next week. But for this one, I'm going to go with a 7 for Matrix Reloaded. And I think it's worth watching. And I'm not sure what to make of what they're doing coming out later this year. And so, Pat, I wanted to get your take on what do you think they're working on? Do you have any readings in on this?
I don't. The last thing I remember seeing about it was a picture of Keanu Reeves walking across the crosswalk with one of the Wachowski sisters. So I don't know exactly what they're planning. I don't know what direction they go in, but it has to be better than Revelations.
What would you like to see out of this new project here, Pat?
I don't know. I'd like to see something that has a good storyline, but something that challenges orthodox beliefs. Something like the first Matrix movie that is like a secret ninja bomb planted deep in people's psyche, like a Larkin Rose Candles in the Dark type thing that people don't know they're ingesting, but they're ingesting it regardless.
I think it
would only be good if it challenged, like in a true Matrix way, if it really challenged orthodox beliefs in a way that was cool, because that was the strength of the original Matrix movies.
Yeah, absolutely. Giving you something to chew on in your brain and your eyeballs, and it's just cooler than anything you've seen before.
That being said, it can't be any better than John Wick, because I love John Wick movies. Like they could make 20 of them. I think I've said this on your show before. They could make 20 fucking John Wick movies, and I would love every single one of them. just as much as the first one. So I don't know how you can top that right now.
I keep hearing about it. I got to watch John Wick. I haven't done it yet. And there's like three or four of them out now.
It's awesome.
That's okay. Well, once I get
the first one, the first one was a lot of fun, but you know, avenging his dead dog or something like that. So, you know,
you can't take it too seriously. It's like, okay, I'm here to watch awesome, like neo-noir action, kung fu, shoot 'em up films. It's not, you can't look too much into it. It's just, it is what it is.
So he's basically Neo again.
Basically, yeah.
Okay.
He's the Boba Yaga. He's the the boogeyman. He's a mafia hitman, and he gets crossed, and he just kills everything.
Okay, well, I'll give that a watch. It's been recommended.
Gold coins. There's gold coins in it, so I don't know what you wouldn't like about it.
We're gonna have to have you back, Pat. You've been on, I think, almost a dozen times. Mike's been on about a dozen times too. So we're going back to the well on that. But why don't you just remind everyone where they can find your podcast, and then we will sign off and get into some Kathleen Turner Overdrive.
Awesome. Yeah. Hey, thanks for having me on, you guys. I really appreciate it. It's always a good time. I'm so glad that we've been friends for so long. It's really special. So now that shit's out of the way, libertyweekly.net is where you can find me. Also on the Libertarian Institute at libertarianinstitute.org, alongside other fine podcasts. So until next time.
Until next time. All right. Well, next time we will be back with The Matrix Revolutions with Mike C. of Mechanical Dream Revolution. And you guys can support the work we do here. Go to lastnerves.com/Patreon, get some of that Kathleen Turner Overdrive and pre-show bonus content. You can find the show notes and more for this at lastnerves.com/176. We will have all of Pat's prior appearances with us on the show, and also links to Libertarian Institute and also his show at libertyweekly.net. And with that, we'll say goodnight from last night, everyone. We will see you guys next week. Peace out. All right, and we will continue the transmission for a few more minutes on the Actual Anarchy podcast, talking about The Matrix Reloaded. And I have saved a question for this one, and I'm wondering, and I'll go to you, Pat. The commander's name was Locke, actually, and he did the very common statist governmental proclamation that this is the single biggest threat we have ever faced as a justification for all of the things that he wanted to do. And as Rahm Emanuel said, you never want a crisis to go to waste. And what ends up happening is all those things that you wanted to do but couldn't get passed through, well, now's the time to drag them out. And so I thought that this was an interesting quote to kind of relate to present day, as I think of the Locke character as being a little bit like a Fauci-type character, utilizing the pretense of emergency to basically control your life. And I guess once you get a taste of that power, you don't want to let it go. So I think that's where he's at now. What's your take on that?
Well, I mean, that's kind of what happens pretty much. I mean, and he seems like, as I imagine blue-pilled libertarians to be, is they talk about pragmatism, but they are the ones that seem to me to be the most susceptible to the ring of power influence. If I can cross-pollinate a little bit here. Is that the impression that you get?
I could see that.
I think one interesting aspect to note is that even if he isn't reaching for power, even if he has the noblest of intentions, once they get that power, it will seem, hey, we fought off this fight because we took that power. We can't give it up now. It's just a pragmatic decision to do. You'd be a fool to give it back now. We got all these great things done and we saved everybody, right? So we're just being the good custodians of Zion by maintaining this power and control. Never mind the fact that we are, limited in knowledge, and we have the knowledge problem and the morality problem and all those problems. Those things can all go by the wayside. We won. We're winners. We need to maintain it, and we're good. Those things all go through, I think, every politician, every bureaucrat, every monster's mind, that we're good and we need to be in control.
Right. And even beyond that, there's also, because they're an expert at one particular field, it's sort of assumed that, well, they're smart guys, so they must know about all of this wide breadth of different topics and things. And so we should go to them for their wisdom and listen to them and don't question them whatsoever, because that's how science works. Not questioning authority.
That's right. The technocracy is real.
Do you think, interesting hypothetical, do you think that Ron Paul, if he was elected president, would have been corrupted by the office? Or more likely, do you think that someone like Nick Sarwark, if elected to president, would have been corrupted? Same old, same old.
Yeah, Ron Paul knows too much, and he's principled. I don't see it happening. I think even with every diktat he gave, he would know that he's using authoritarian control and that he's undermining all kinds of people's independent will and that kind of thing.
Yeah,
Sarwak, he's a snake, some kind of CIA plant. I think that's garbage.
Did you see that picture of him on Twitter that he posted? It was like a casual picture of him laying in bed with his little Band-Aid on his shoulder and like kind of a smile about getting vaccinated.
Yeah, it looked like a dating profile or something. It was weird.
It did. It was fucking weird. Shit.
Yeah.
Now, I don't want to cross-pollinate too much, but have you ever heard, like, there's some YouTube channels that talk about what if Gandalf had taken the ring for himself? They do like the Lord of the Rings, like whatever hypos. I don't know. I just picture Ron Paul being like Gandalf the Grey, and he takes the ring and uses it for good. And he ends up being like, it's really funny because like Gandalf ends up being a good Sauron. Like he's a fascist who ends up like trying to instigate for good, but he still is a fascist.
Right.
So, So there's a YouTube video on that one. If it's still up.
Okay. Yeah, it's good.
Yeah. Find that one or I'll try to find it and I'll put it on the show notes page. That's interesting. I would imagine that Gandalf, you know, in the original movies and in the book, he says to Frodo that the ring would be too powerful and it would corrupt him. So he wouldn't want to wield it. So it is a, you know, that's a nice counterfactual, I guess, related to the fictional novel. But I think that Ron Paul would have been different than Gandalf, or like he would have been similar to the Gandalf we see in the movie, where he wouldn't want to wield that power. But if he had been elected, I think that he would have remained true to the principles as best as he could. So I don't know. That's just my take on the guy. I think, like Robert was saying, he knows too much. Yeah. You know, he knows the corrupting influences of this power. And I think that Right. And, you know, even in the campaigns, he had to say that he was trying to win or whatever. But I think that really he knew deep down that he was just trying to stay on message and educate and inspire and get people to look into these ideas. And I got to say, he was probably the most effective person at it in my lifetime. You know, he's the reason that I'm talking to you. He's the reason I even met you.
Same.
He's the reason I ruined Robert's life. So...
Indeed. It looks back. Causality. Well, maybe Dave Smith might has a chance to overtake Ron Paul if he does end up running or increases his platform. He's still growing. So he has a chance, and he's a young man. He has a long time to expand his reach. So maybe in his lifetime, or maybe one of our lifetimes.
And he's been on Rogan, what, 6 times now? I mean, that's a pretty big platform as well.
Yeah.
And this last one, man, he wasn't pulling very many punches in that one. It's great.
Killed it.
Yeah. So kudos to you, Dave. Doing great. Great work, man. Inspiring. And anyway, speaking of inspiring, you guys can inspire us to continue to do this here show by supporting us on Patreon. Go to patreon.com/actualanarchy or actualanarchy.com/patreon. Either one. Try one. And if it doesn't work, then try the other. You can also go to trubster.com. That's Robert's wares for sale. Go to trubbster.com and you can buy t-shirts, mugs, pillows, fleece, blankets, and other random stuff that gets your graphical inventions printed on them, right, Robert? Something like that?
That's exactly correct, Daniel. Yes, thank you.
All right, so you have natural salesman here. And also check out our guest's website at libertyweekly.net and go to libertarianinstitute.org to find his work, as well as that of Scott Horton, Pete Quinones, Keith Knight, and others. And with that, we will see you guys all next week for The Matrix Revolutions with Mike C. of Mechanical Dream Revolution. And we'll say goodnight. Maximum freedom, everyone. Peace out.
Chipmunks. C-H-I-P-M-U-N-K. We're the chipmunks. Guaranteed to brighten your day. Do-do. Do-do-do-do. Do-do. Do-do-do-do.